members from the Office of the Chief Justice, members of the Department of Justice and Correctional Services, and to all everybody who's watching us from home.
Recording in progress.
Welcome to our first meeting of the quarter. Today we will be dealing with a briefing on procurement from the Office of the Chief Justice, which will be followed by the Land Court Bill and the Cannabis Bill. SG, are you ready? SG?
Good morning, Chairperson, can you hear me?
Yes, no, we can hear you and can hear you.
Okay, good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. We are ready with the members of the OCJ Executive. I don't know if there's a need for introductions, but in the interest of time, we can proceed.
Please do.
You are here, Chairperson.
Yes, please do. You can proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson and Honorable Members. We have been requested by the Portfolio Committee for a presentation on the report on the OCJ on allegations relating to the Capeline project procurement. The presentation outline will touch on the background, the background, the sole source procurement, the subcontracting, internal OCJ task team, business continuity, governance, ethics and risk, and strengthening of internal controls and closure. The purpose of the presentation is to present, to provide to the committee the report, as already indicated before, we see this line on Caseline project. In terms of the background, we just want to highlight that the Caseline, I mean the court online or the e-filing project, of which Caseline is but a component, was supported by the OCJ as a project led by the judiciary, which has its history in the Master Systems Plan, to modernize the superior courts and ensure digital transformation initiatives are in place to improve service delivery. And this was done in the spirit of modernization, that Court Online was identified as a priority project, which we have done in close cooperation with the State Information and Technology Agency, which we started in September 2017. That was the first request we gave to CITA to initiate a project, a process to put Court Online in, I mean, e-filing in place. Maybe just a comment, Chairperson and members, as I present where we see Court Online, initially it was e-filing. So where I use the same term, it refers to the same. So the Court Online system consists of two separate yet interlinked systems. One is case management solution, which is called the CRM Dynamics. And the CRM Dynamics is mostly the part of the system that is used by the officials inside for case registration and management, etc. To a certain extent, the judges will have a dashboard to see them, some of the cases that are allocated to them, not everything. The second part of the system is the evidence management solution, which is the Caseline software, which is an integral part of the end-to-end solution Court Online. The Court Online system is piloted in Gauteng Division of the High Court, and this division represents over 50%, 52% of civil cases in all the High Courts or Superior Courts. The rollout of the system is planned for the MTEF period, And the project is mainly supported and funded through the IJS. In support of this project, a procurement process was initiated in 2021 for the evidence management part of the court online, which is the case line system, since for the 36 months contract for licenses, which included support and maintenance. What this point means that initially when we procure case lines, it was for 36 months with a reseller, and which was piloted in Gauteng Division as a standalone, not operating as two parts CRM Dynamics as well as the case line combination. So I'm just clarifying this so that it is clear that the court online is offset two parts, one case line, one CRM Dynamics. But this 2021 piloting housing was only a standalone case line for 36 months with a reseller, which expired in March 2022. On the 10th of December, following a sole source procurement process, we awarded a contract to Thomson Reuters to provide the software licenses and resources and support maintenance, including professional services for a period of 60 months, commencing 1 April 2022. This was post the 36 months contract expiry, which was in preparation for the next phase of piloting the total solution now in housing in preparation for rollout nationwide. In terms of the award to Thomson Reuters, which is an international company, was required to subcontract 50% of the services to a qualifying small enterprise, QSE, and EME, exempt micro enterprise registered in South Africa. On the 20th of December, Treasury was informed as per the rules about the procurement as contemplated in instruction number 8 of National Treasury 8 of 2007-8. On 25th January 2022, Treasury informed us that it was not in agreement with our procurement process. An extensive engagement ensued between the OCJ and Treasury, in part, which also included participation of CETA and Microsoft, who was busy, who is tasked with the development of the total solution, including the CRM part. And the engagement ended up in the mediation process, which later the National Treasury agreed with us and noted the deviation accordingly. Thomson Reuters commenced with their licensing services on 1 April 22 with the support and maintenance to start on 1st June. And on the 16th of May, Thomson Reuters, as prescribed, informed us that the subcontractor formally provided OCJ with details of the QSE-based company that is subcontracted for support and maintenance. And at that stage, it was noted that the company that's subcontracting through Thomson Reuters is three directors of the company are employees of the OCJ. And we followed the due, SEM followed the due ROPS, which is the remuneration workout. Yes. This is a policy relating, I'm not able to call it properly, but this is a policy relating to doing remuneration work whilst you are inside the public service in terms of the ethics policies of government. By then, the three directors of the company that was subcontracted, ZA Square, were still employed by the OCJ and were already serving resignation by the end of May. Following the above, obviously, subsequent to that, we formed a task team of senior officials convened by myself, which was subsequent also to what I have indicated in the last slide, as well as the media issues that were raised. I think there were a few articles that appeared in the media around this issue relating to the contract as well as the three officials. And we dealt with that. We issued our statements, etc. Following that, I convened the EXCO and selected a team of officials with whom I will work with to begin to review and assemble the documentary trail pertaining to the contract and the award. As you would understand that the officials, the two officials or the three officials mainly who had played a major role in the contract had left. And we created a first deliverables and events timeline for contextual purposes. And our forensic unit was activated, which undertook subsequent investigation. And investigations are ongoing, and the OCJ is therefore not in the position to provide any further information, as this may also negatively impact the investigations. And also to indicate that the OCJ, the forensic unit, is also busy with the documentation. I think maybe to pause here, Honorable Chairperson and members, that it will be difficult for the OCJ to disclose most of the issues relating to the investigations, as it also involves the part of the work that is being done, as well as contractual issues, as well as possible litigation or even processes that could end up with PRECA and other related legislation that impacts on what has happened, which is subject to investigations. I would ask the committee's indulgence in that regard. In due course, when the investigations are completed, I myself will present to the committee on the facts as they appear, as they come out of the investigation, so that the committee is on board. The next slide deals with business continuity to prevent any interruption in services. The OCJ engaged with Thomson Reuters also, who committed to ensure that the services that are already supposed to be to be rendered are not interrupted. And Thomson Reuters, the contractor, subsequently informed us through their media release also that they have also, on their part, instituted internal investigations, and that the services provided by subcontractors with a square is suspended until further notice, which is the case up to now. And there were non-payments made by the OCJ in terms of this contract in view of the issues that have arisen and in view of the investigation and in view of the consequences that will follow out of the investigation. From a business continuity point of view, maybe just to highlight some of the facts. As I've already indicated before, we had Caseline, which was standalone, piloted in Gauteng Division, Joburg and Pretoria. And we were moving in March 2022 when we procured with Thomson Reuters for the final piloting of the total solution, meaning we're moving from standalone now to the full component, meaning the CRM Dynamics as well as the Caseline together being piloted in Gauteng from March, so that we prepare for the rollout outside Gauteng to the other superior courts. Now, in terms of the status of the pilot, I could just share a few statistics just to give an indication of where we are. We have over 3,373 law firms registered in the system. We have 4,735 portal users, which is the users, meaning the litigants, the public, the lawyers, etc., excluding the judges and the staff. We have over 182, a combination of 82 active judges and 100 acting judges who are already trained and registered in the system. And as at 9 o'clock today, we have over 17,000 cases issued in the CRM system to date. So we have a bulk of the system of the civil cases. Active cases are actually the total population of active civil cases in the Gauteng Division are in the system. Governance, ethics and risk management. Given the crisis that we faced, the EXCO was called to reflect on the risks that we have faced that has materialized in this instance with this procurement and its potential impact on the judiciary that it serves. And in this regard, I have ensured that we put in place certain mechanisms to make sure that our internal controls, as well as our processes, our SOPs and policies are strengthened. The executive management, executive committee is looking at that, as well as our management, to ensure that we check where would some of these gaps that would have eventuated the situation occur. This is work in progress that we have engaged on. We also implemented this risk-based approach so that the potential risk to mitigate the adverse impact on the judiciary is also looked at. And maybe whilst I'm here, in terms of the risk with the judiciary, is the unfortunate part that for which I stand to apologize to the judiciary for it, because of the name of the institution. When things like this happen, the name of the institution, being the Office of the Chief Justice, directly impacts, as if it is the judges or the Chief Justice involved in the administrative side of things, a matter which I think will need to be looked at. In terms of strengthening of internal controls, we take the fiduciary duty to manage and protect state resources entrusted to us seriously as the OCJ. We are reviewing all the supply chain management processes. We are looking at the membership of the relevant committees in the BIT processes to ensure that we find ways to enhance the technical capacity and strengthen further internal controls in SCM, meaning that we have now, as EXCO, also identified SCM as a high risk in our institution to be looked at closely. We are conducting a review of contracts, especially in the ICT space, as it is where most of the money, as we know, technology is very expensive and its products and services. To this end, we bear the responsibility to ensure that where perception and wrongdoing is established in the procurement processes, and that we will identify that and based on legal counsel that we are under, determine the best way forward, guided by the obviously the precepts that we have to follow. Also, just to indicate that we have counsel that we have through the state attorney acquired, with whom we work with, and we take counsel on the issues relating to this matter, as it is already a contract that is in place. So that we are able to manage all the risks and ensure that as the investigation ensue and as we come across information that needs to be dealt with in terms of the risks, in terms of the institution and impact, we are able to take proper legal advice from senior counsel in this regard. So we're taking the very cautious approach because this matter has serious implications going forward. In closure, Honorable Chairperson and members, we commit that we will ensure myself and the EXCO that we take a prudent approach. And with regard to details, I've already indicated specific details. We cannot be able to disclose them at this stage. And we are not saying so because we want to hide anything. As I've said, I commit that at the appropriate time and based on legal advice, I will myself lead the team to account fully on what actually happened in this instance. We value the oversight by the portfolio committee, and we undertake that any impropriety in the use of public funds will be addressed, and we are prepared to account fully, as I've already indicated. The audit committee has been briefed also on this matter, and they are aware of what I have just presented to the committee today. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I will pause there and take questions from members with my team.
Thank you very much, SG. Members, before we proceed, I forgot to to inform the committee about the apologies that we have received. We have an apology of Honorable Engelberg, who might be joining us late. He is attending another meeting. And then we have an apology of Honorable Janji, who is chairing the Section 194 Committee. Honorable Nola is with us, but he is shuttling between us and Section 194 Committee. Those are the apologies that I have received, members. Committee Secretary, do you have any additional apologies?
No, Chair. I'm not sure about one.
No apologies, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think the apologies would be noted. I have the following members. I have Honorable Dennis Breitenbach, Honorable Werner Horn, Honorable Swart, Honorable Nivot Drachens, in that order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to everybody. I'm somewhat perturbed by this presentation. It does not impart a lot of information about this matter, and this matter is obviously a matter of deep concern. So I understand that there's an investigation that's ongoing and that information should not be given that would compromise that investigation. I do think, though, that the Office of the Chief Justice has been particularly parsimonious with the information that they've shared with us today. Everything they've shared with us today, we could have read in the newspapers. In fact, we have read in the newspapers. So I'm not feeling at all enlightened by this presentation. I'd like to know from the Office of the Chief Justice, and I might have missed this in the presentation. These three positions are very senior positions. Have they filled them? Have they advertised them? Are they filled? Are there people performing this job? And if so, who? And where did they come from? I'd also like to know how three such senior members of a not very big organization can plan and lead simultaneously, submit their resignation simultaneously, I presume, or in very short shift of each other. How this could not have raised red flags, how questions were not asked about this mess. Resignation of three very senior members. Did they do exit interviews? And if so, what were the results thereof? And then did these three staff members disclose their interest in the company Zeta Square Consulting? If so, when? What was the nature of that interest? Did they declare an extraneous income or was there no income? We need a lot more information in this regard. This is a serious, serious matter. And it's mystifying how three such very senior members, such very high profile in the public's face members could have planned this thing without it being detected in the normal course of business. So I'm really not feeling at all comfortable. I'm not feeling like I know any more about what's going on here, and I'm not feeling like the Office of the Chief Justice has a handle on this, and it appears that everything that they're doing is retroactive and there was nothing that was done that was proactive, and I'd really like a lot more information on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Breitenbach. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning from my side. Chair, let me at the outset say I share the sentiments of the Honourable Breitenbach around the scantness of the information supplied to us this morning. It's one thing to say the Office of the Chief Justice value the oversight of this committee, and then it's another thing to 2 months after the news broke, come and basically share the information that's already publicly available, and then say we must just trust processes to unfold, and that further information cannot be shared because that could have an impact on investigations. So I think the first question that must be answered is exactly how far is the investigation? 2 months down the line, with the first focus being on a very specific procurement, one would think that the basic facts around this would be simple enough for the investigation into this to have proceeded far enough for us to be afforded sufficient information to have oversight. Then in line with that, a few specific questions. The presentation talk about a sole procurement process. So the question is, at what stage or at what time did the Office of the Chief Justice make the determination that this would be the type of procurement where a sole procurement process is to be followed, and ultimately whether the subcontractor that ultimately is at the nub of this specific matter was by then already established. Then specifically the question is to, in respect of making the decision that there's a sole entity that ultimately qualifies to be awarded the contract, was the three members, who ultimately is also seemingly the shareholders of the subcontractor, involved in the decision that there's only one company that can provide this service? So one talks about, if one now wants to refer to the lingo that is used, bid evaluation and bid adjudication. So in simple terms, were these three members involved in those processes? In terms of the subcontractor company, are these three members the only shareholders? And if so, what is the percentage of shares they respectively hold in the company? In terms of the references to possible litigation, the one question that has not been answered is what is the status of the award? Is that still in place with an understanding that the subcontractor must be replaced? Has any payments been made in terms of the contract? And if so, what percentage, and if the contract is still in place with the sole service provider, to what extent has services then started? And then finally, reference is being made in respect of the scrutiny of other contracts. Can we be afforded information as to whether any indication at this stage has been identified, or whether there is any indication that improper actions also were present in awarding other contracts of the Office of the Chief Justice, and if so, which contracts are in play there? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Horn. Honourable Swart.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning to my colleagues, and good morning to the Secretary General. Thank you for the presentation. But I do want to share my colleagues' concerns about the lack of information. There's a lot of information in the media, and maybe I do appreciate that there's an ongoing investigation, but we need answers. And Chair, it could be that in responding to these questions, maybe the Secretary General can respond in writing, but I do share the concerns that we're not any nearer to what has happened. In fact, there's far more information in the media, and we need to thank the media for exposing this, because the question arises, had they not exposed it, would it actually have been exposed or come to light, given the fact that there appears to be approval for tender of deviations? And we know, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, that the Secretary General must ensure procurement and provision that is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. And of course, the Secretary General also apologized, in as much as it is an office of the judiciary, the Chief Justice's office. And yes, we need to reiterate that this is a separate department from the judiciary. But the impact would require the highest level of integrity when it comes to supply chain management and procurement practices. Now, that having been said, I think it's very important for us to mention that we know that from the media that this company was formed 5 days after the contract was awarded to Thomson Reuters. 5 days by these high-level members of the department. That was on the 15th of December 2021. Surely there should have been some red alarm or some red flag there. Now, the former chief financial officer is reported to have said in a news article that he saw no issue with him overseeing the bid adjudication committee of the OCJ and then later winning the contract with Thomson Reuters. How can that possibly be so? And there was also a comment from a Mr. Thurby, the former case management, the former chief director of court administration, that because their contract began on 1 June, the company had not earned any income until the employment at the OCJ ended. So I appreciate these issues are all being investigated, but it smacks of the highest level of what would appear to be impropriety. And that was pointed out by the Zondo Commission into state capture, the issue related to procurement. So that having been said, I think the issue which is now before us is, was the when the office of the CJ appeared before the committee on the 3rd of May, I would like to know whether the office was then, whether Secretary General, you were then aware that three senior staffers, the Chief Financial Officer, the Chief Director of Court Administration and Case Management Director, had resigned at that time. Why were we not advised at that stage? Secondly, I think it's important, Mr. Van der Born's question about the filling of those vacancies at senior management level, when will that be attended to? This is a small organization. How can you operate without these senior officials? Thirdly, I understand also from media reports that it is estimated that the investigation will take 3 months. Is that an indication so that we can get greater clarity on this issue? And then there is an issue relating to the 1 April 2022 National Treasury Supply Chain Management Instruction, Enhancing Compliance, Note 3, which was issued to reduce the abuse of supply chain management system. Was this applied in this situation? Yes, it was before that, but is this part of the process that will enhance supply chain management? That note, 1 April 2022. Thank you, Chair. For the time being, that'll be my questions, and I'm sure we will need to engage later on these issues, given the fact that we were not given much information because of the pending investigation. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swart, Honourable Jelle. Oh, sorry, Honourable Nivot Trahan, then Honourable Jelle. My apologies.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And good morning to everybody on the platform and good morning to the officials from the OCJ. Thank you for your presentation. Okay, Secretary, the frames keep moving. I would like to add my concerns and share the sentiments of my members, of my colleagues who have spoken before me, that there's scant information that has been provided today. But yes, we'll respect the process that an investigation must ensue. I don't want to raise the same questions as my colleagues. However, I do want to understand who was on the team when the bid was adjudicated or evaluated. Were these three officials participating throughout this entire process? And was there, you know, at no time did they declare their participation or their involvement in this procurement? And then secondly, when did the OCJ pick up that there is some kind of issue? Is it when it was exposed by the media, or did OCJ have some kind of suspicion before this matter went public? The SG says that you're going to be evaluating the contracts that have been awarded. Have you discovered anything so far in this evaluation? And then what raises, because of this situation, does it mean that the funds that are allocated to this project will be suspended, or are you continuing with the process? Does this mean that, you know, the services will continue, considering that they were supposed to start earlier, or are you going to suspend the services? Because, of course, these are critical services for the users. Another question of mine would be that, does the SG have enough internal support so that all business processes can continue? And, or did, you know, did, yeah, so did other staff members perhaps in the team also pick up any irregularities? Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Yvonne Strachan. Honorable Masako Jala.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, colleagues, and also to the SG and the team. Chairperson, I have only a few questions that are maybe clarity questions. I think, let me just piggyback you on the last question of Honorable Verma. sorry for that. In terms of being aware of what is happening within the procurement services or within the OCJ as an institution, do we I just want to find out that was there any sign of something wrong that is happening before this occurs? Maybe that they might have been aware of that, they maybe did not take it serious, okay, in terms of how the things are done in terms of e-procurement. Because this gives me the impression, Chair, that maybe this was not the only one. Maybe there has been other procurement services that has been these three officials have been involved in that maybe were not flagged to the institution that there is something wrong happening there. Because it also gives the impression that this has been done intentionally. These officials had enough time to do this, as I suspect that it is not the first time, Chair. I would like the SG to comment on that one. And then also, Chairperson, my question is that to the SG. The three officials have, because when from the presentation we hear that when they became aware of this matter, the three officials have already submitted their resignations, and I wanted to find out that was there anything done in terms of the pension funds, payment of the pension funds, holding them or making them, because this thing has been done intentionally, that maybe to make sure that we don't suffer loss, Chairperson. Was there any intention of maybe saying holding the pension fund or anything that was due to them, to those officials? I think that is the only question that I'll end up with, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chele. SJ, and maybe just one question. Who is doing the investigation? Is it an internal investigation, or are you using the law enforcement agencies? Over to you, SJ.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can you speak more? Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and members. It is really a very difficult day, but we have to account. I will deal with, I will club some of the questions that are related to one another with your permission, Chairperson and members, and in areas where we will not be able to offer direct, I will indicate so. The feeling of they have the three positions of the officials being filled, and I will deal with that also with regard to the question that relates to who is now doing the job and the capacity issue. The three positions became vacant at the end of May, and they have already been advertised. The CFO, the Director Case Management, as well as the Chief Director for Court Administration, who was also the spokesperson of the judiciary, as you know. The positions have been advertised. We are in the process of filling them. Advertisements have already issued, closed, and they have closed. And we are in the process of interviews as well as the later processes with a view to ensure that they are filled in the next month or two. Obviously taking into consideration the assumption of duties and the notices for those who will be coming in. So they have been advertised. I can give the dates of advertisement was in June already. Yeah, all three of them were advertised in June. So they will be filled in the next two, three months. The question relating to now who's doing the job, it is a matter that I have also, as we are a very small department, the total of the SMS members is even under 40, I think we're 38. And with the three that have left and the work that they were doing, two of them sitting in the core business, which is called administration, obviously left a gap. So I have taken the decision to appoint an acting CFO from within the finance team, as well as the acting for court administration. One of the directors in court administration is acting. Ms. Tabiana Gul is acting. Ms. Kola Morabed is acting CFO. And Ms. Valerie, what is Valerie's name?
Nakali.
Valerie Nakali is acting in the director case management position. So there are acting positions. I mean, there are acting persons in these three positions already, who happens to be three African ladies. So this has an impact that now obviously a gap is lost behind because of the gap that they have to step in. So we are trying to make sure that we cover all areas whilst we are struggling with this. As you've already seen in my presentation, I indicated that I put a team together and these three are part of the team that I'm working with, being a small department, to work on this matter. This matter is also under investigations, as already indicated, and some of the officials, there was a question on who was sitting in the bid adjudication, in the committees of the process of adjudication. These officials also, may I mention, honorable members, that they are also part of the investigation, which the law enforcement agency is looking at, which answers the question, are we investigating internally? Yes, internally we are, as well as law enforcement agencies involved. So these officials are also under questions by the investigation team. And I would appeal to the committee that I don't raise names so that we leave the investigation to deal with that it has to deal with. At the appropriate time, I promise you, I will be able to give you the details because this is public information that you deserve. Whether the official disclosed their interest during the period of this process, the answer is no. When they were sitting in the processes of procurement, obviously there are requirements that you declare whether you have any interest. They declared that they have no interest in the company or in the anything relating to the process. And that ties to the question whether we knew in advance. We did not know. I did not know until the matter was already, people were already resigning, and the company was informing us about the subcontracting situation. So we did not know in advance. We did not suspect, I did not suspect there was anything untoward that was happening. And I had no reason to suspect that anything was untoward because I did not find anything that in my view would have given me reason to believe that they were doing anything untoward. But obviously it's human nature. What happens, it happens. And the director, so the ZA Square subcontractor is the sole, they are the three sole directors according to the records. And their share division is that Mr. Nube is 51% shareholder, and Mr. Kutzer is 25%, and Ms. Van Nicker is 24% shareholding, the total of which is 100% for the three of them. What was the other question that I want to bring to this? The question was raised of the role played by the three in the procurement process of the TR or Thomson Reuters contract. In this effect, they all played a role, both from the bid specifications to the bid evaluation, as well as the BAC, as it was part of their official duties, including the negotiation process or the pricing relating to the contract. So their fingerprints is everywhere in this procurement process. They were integrally involved with the contract. There was a question raised whether the contract review has picked up anything untoward. As at today, we have not picked anything, but the process is still unfolding. Preliminarily, we have not seen anything untoward. There is one case that we are following on that was in the media from PKC, which we are looking at, which relates to one official who had left earlier also. But the matter is also part of investigation, which we will not dwell into the details until we have. A question was asked about the status of the contract with Thomson Reuters and whether payment has been made. There hasn't been any payment. As soon as I became aware of the situation, I did not process any payment in relation to this matter as the risk management decision, so that should anything come out later, that's is going to put this contract in jeopardy. One would have protected the state funds. So no funds have been paid. The status of the contract, we are subject to legal counsel, and maybe also to indicate that we are also in engagement with the contractor, Thompson Reuters. Us as a team in our council and their team in their council are engaging. So this matter impacts exactly on what the engagement is going to be with regard to the contract. So legally speaking and technically speaking, the contract is on because the services are required. There was a question asked about the impact on the cost. As I had already indicated, I think the statistics with regards to the impact on the court. We have done an impact assessment as the OCG as part of the work that we're doing relating to this contract to assess what is going to happen in the event that we don't have a system like his line. And the outcome of the assessment is that, as I've already indicated, currently we are piloting counting the total solution, meaning we've shifted from the standalone case line to now case line as part of the integral part of the system. 100% of the total population of civil cases in Gauteng Division of the High Court is in the court online e-filing system. That 100% represents, as I've said, by this morning, over 17,000 cases, and it's still growing as we speak. It must have gone up. So if we look at this number and it's a total population of the civil caseload of the division, which is the biggest division in the country, the impact will be devastating. So dealing with this contract, we have to move very carefully, not because of the company, but because of the service that we need. It is our discussion with our council and the team that the approach that will be taken must ensure that the court does not suffer, because that is the most important part. Because the over 600 or so law firms are already registered, and there is also over 150,000 outcomes, court case outcomes that are in the system that will be affected. We cannot go back to a manual system. That cannot be an option, because we don't even have the storage capacity to do that. The practice directives issued by the judge president of the division on civil is really on ensuring that all civil matters goes on the system. So the system was at an advanced stage, but it will be quite really sad if we have to lose those cases. So the question now becomes, what do we do? We are working, as I'm saying, my team and council and the contractor are working on a solution to ensure that the impact is not great. As I've already indicated in the presentation, we have agreed that the services must continue whilst we sort out the issues that have occasions for us. 4,750 lawyers are already in the system and registered, so that will be the impact. So we are prioritizing making sure that whilst we look at and address the procurement issues that are arising to save the system and make sure that the courts are able to function properly and go forward. There was another question that there was a question whether I have enough support to continue the services and whether any regularities have picked. I think I've commented on that. I do not have sufficient support in view of the gaps that are occasioned by what is happening. And I think the capacity really also talks to the budget cuts that the OCJ is faced with regards to the COE, which also impacts on the other things Goods and Services budget cuts. It is not easy to replace positions as and when they become, in general terms, as when they become vacant because of the ceilings that have been put on COE, which is a macro issue relating to the reduction of the wage bill, we understand that. But to answer the question directly, I don't have sufficient support, but I have a team that is dedicated to ensure that we can cover all the areas that we can under the circumstances. Did the evaluation of the contract show any improper conduct? I've already alluded that not at the stage when the processes were unfolding. It was only after the fact that it was realized that the three officials were involved in this contract as interest. With regards to the question relating to the pension funds, may I stay clear of that, because the law enforcement agencies and the investigation are dealing with that part, and at the appropriate time I will disclose what is the position with regards to that. There was a question relating to the CFO and the court administration chief director relating to the comments that they made in the media that they do not see anything wrong in what has happened. I think as the OCJ, it is quite very clear. I do not agree with the sentiments that they express, but I would like to reserve my comments so that I can allow the processes that are going to unfold appropriate time not to ventilate these issues in the public space. And I would like the committee to indulge me in that regard. The SCM treasury note to reduce the abuse of the system. We have implemented the instruction note as the OCG. And our engagement and discussions with the National Treasury on these issues also, I think they have contributed to them making sure that they clarify some of these issues in these notes. Not that we take credit, but we are saying that we have contributed in the clarity that they have to make sure that it is given. There was an issue raised relating to the sole provider. How do we establish that fact or whatever, it's a matter that is under investigation as information that the investigators are collecting relating to the interactions that happens between the OCJ and the company that has been contracted. So may I stay clear of this one at the appropriate time, I'll inform you what has been uncovered.
There was a question from Honorable Breitenbach on the exit interviews.
Oh, the exit interviews. We can provide that information later. But I'm doubtful. The general practice that one has sent in the department is that people don't really disclose much in the interview exit, in the review that we have done in the past. People just indicate personal reasons or they indicate pursuing other interests without disclosing much. But we can, I have not necessarily looked at their exit interview. We can provide that information later on. One question related also to us providing a written report. That I agree with, that at the appropriate time, a report in writing will be provided to the committee and that they deserve to know what has happened and went wrong. The PFMA responsibilities of the accounting office are acknowledged and they stand clear in the act, in which so far we have tried, or I have tried as accounting officer, to ensure that I guard against, but these things do happen. It is a lesson that we are not proud of, and as I've said, immediately we convened at EXCO to begin to look at what are the internal controls tightening up that we need to do to ensure that these things, procurement policies as well as standard operating procedures are tightened in this regard. I have addressed the bid adjudication committee and to also impress upon them that the SCM as well as the technical people in these processes need to play a major role and be allowed to make sure that some of these things are identified far in advance. And I must also mention, honorable members, that we are a very small department, and sometimes it becomes very difficult to get more people into the processes because the only way to make sure that people don't play major roles in many areas is when we have many officials at the appropriate level to be able to do these things. And when we have to rely on external people, our processes take too long because people commit and people have their other priorities where they work, and it becomes very difficult for them to commit. So being a very small department also is a risk, but we cannot do procurement and not do procurement because we are afraid that people will be playing major roles. Unfortunately, it is the nature of where we find ourselves in. I am not making it as an excuse that we should not be prudent, but I'm just highlighting the fact that one of the issues that impacts on that is exactly the fact that we are a small department, and being a small department, unfortunately, when you see that an official has played a role in the process, a prominent role, it raises eyebrows, but the context is that we are a small department, otherwise it becomes very difficult. The maintenance and support, there was a question around this, the services of the subcontractor. The maintenance support by the subcontractor has been suspended, and the main contractor is the one providing the services. And as I've said, we are busy engaged with our council, both sides, on the contract status so that we can resolve that issue, and as well as priority defending the and making sure that business continuity and the system of civil in the High Courts of Gauteng are not negatively impacted. Those investigations, I think I've answered that one. I've indicated they did not declare their procurement, and that we were not aware during the process of the procurement processes of their interest in the company. They did not inform us about that in advance. And in the form, they indicated that they had no interest. And at that time, because we were not aware, there was no reason for us to suspect that there was anything. Scrutiny of contract, I think I've found. Status of the contract. Did I answer the shareholding?
Yes, you did. You did. You did give us a breakdown of the shareholding.
I don't know if I've skipped anything, Honorable Chairperson and members, but I did not. Yes.
Honorable Swart asked about the 3 months that was said the investigation is going to take 3 months.
Oh, yes, that we are expecting that the investigation should be concluded by the end of September. By the end of September, we'll be able to give guidance. I mean, sorry, to give information on what the status is. And I think because we have committed to 3 months, even if these things do happen, even if it's not completely 100%, we'll still indicate what the status of the investigation outcome is.
Thank you very much, SJ. I have Honorable Swart, Honorable Delbert Drachens, and then Honorable Horn in that order.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, SG. I appreciate the difficulty in being able to answer questions with a pending investigation ongoing. What I would like to just ask you, when you appeared before us on the 3rd of May, I asked a specific question. Were you aware at that stage about the resignations, given the fact that they took effect on the 31st of May? If so, why were we as a committee not taken into confidence that 3 senior members of your executive, your chief financial officer, chief director of court administration, and your court management director had the site. If you weren't aware, then when did you get the letters of resignation? That's the first issue. The second issue, I really appreciate your explanation about the civil cases, the case lines, impact, and Chair, I'm in agreement. There's no ways that one can go back to a manual system. Gauteng is the center of our economic hub. It is hugely important for economic growth. That civil litigation, I myself have been involved in litigation using case lines. It's very, very effective. And I just wanted to find out if the SG has given us an impact study, but if I understood her correctly, she said there's no payment on these contracts. So if there is no payment, is there not a risk, and you indicated that there is ongoing discussions with your council, with you or your team, and with the company involved. Is there not, what is the actual risk if you're not paying that the service could be stopped? I think it's a very, very pertinent question, because one doesn't want to have that impact. And then Chair, we would need some form of regular updates on progress. I'm not sure, I'll be guided by you and the committee, but surely given the extent and the impact and the possible impact on civil litigation in Gauteng, we would need regular updates, maybe in writing to you, Chair. I'd be guided by you. Should it be a fortnightly basis? I'm not sure, a monthly basis, as to progress with this investigation, and most importantly, any impact on civil litigation, particularly in Gauteng, and then, of course, on other litigation across the country. We may also need to engage with the judiciary itself, the Chief Justice himself, as to an understanding of the impact on the courts. Thank you, Chair, for that.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swart. Honourable Nieuwpoort Johan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I left out one question. The use of, I'm trying to understand the use of local company, and at what point in time when you awarded the contract, at what point in time did you want a local company? And then in the recruitment, do the bid adjudicators investigate the companies that are chosen, what skills they have, when were they established, and if they are capable of doing the job? If it's just a new company with no staff, no resources, and doing the job that the main tender required. So, and in terms of the local company, I just wanted to get clarity on that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Nieuwpoort. Honourable Horn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I have a few follow-up questions. The first, on the issue of the shareholding, I would want to know whether, as part of the investigation, the shareholding is also a focus. In the sense that, on the one hand, there's of course the possibility that the shareholding was set up in the way it has been in order to qualify as the BEE subcontractor, but on the other hand, there's also the possibility of silent partners, and specifically then the majority shareholding being a proxy holder, or also on behalf of some unknown person. So I would want to get the assurance that that is part of the investigation. The second question I have, Chair, is in follow-up to the answer on the exit interviews. I mean, I understand that ordinarily exit interviews would be somewhat of a non-event, but in the specific circumstances, there was, of course, a context of three senior managers resigning simultaneously. So apart from the standard question as to why are you leaving us, or I would think that these specific set of exit interviews should have entailed also an interrogation as to why are the three of you leaving at the same time. And then on the issue of declaration of interest, Chair, I also just want some further clarity. I understand that there's, of course, a standard form to be filled in whenever you serve on any internal body that deals with evaluation, and prior to that, hopefully even when you start drafting terms of reference or bit specifics. But in the current circumstances, one would think that in terms of senior management, even if it is a small department, there should also be an annual disclosure of interest. And I have it that some media reports have confirmed that happened in April. So I would want to get a confirmation, firstly, whether a general disclosure of interest happened indeed in April, and whether that specific disclosure of interest, if it happened, whether that indicated any indication as to shareholding in the specific subcontracting company. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn. Honorable Glenis Breitenbach.
Thank you, Chair. I'm struggling to unmute, sorry. Yes, I must say that the Secretary General has been at pains to share as little information as possible, and having difficulty with the phrase, she'll share with us at the appropriate time. This is the appropriate time. This committee has an oversight duty over the Office of the Chief Justice. This is a big deal. This is not some small matter, and I know that she does realise that, but to say to us, she'll share with us, or the office will share with us at the appropriate time, is, I find, mildly patronising. As to say that office will decide when and how to share information with the body that has oversight over them. I must say that I'm somewhat affronted by that approach, and I find it unsatisfactory, and it has placed us in a position now where we are unable to exercise oversight over this entire affair. So we've been told nothing that we didn't know before. We could have read all of this and have read all of this in the newspapers, and we're no closer to unraveling the problem. And if the answers to these questions are not available, then I'm afraid to say neither is the Office of the Chief Justice any closer to unraveling the problem. And to suggest that in September, yes, they'll come back and inform us of the status of the investigation, that's a non-thing. To come back and inform us of the status of the investigation, either it's finished or it's not. I don't have that much interest in the status of the investigation as what I have in the content of the investigation. How this happened, why this happened, what has been done to prevent it happening again, and why it wasn't picked up. Those are the things we need to know to exercise oversight. Not the status of the investigation, or to be told that at the appropriate time, information will be shared with us. It's very easy to hide behind an ongoing investigation. It's not a valid excuse. There's no necessity to share information that would jeopardize the investigation. But a lot more information can and should, and in my view, must be shared on this platform regarding this matter that will not jeopardize the investigation. And so my view is simply that the Office of the Chief Justice does not have a handle on this issue, does not fully understand what has happened, for reasons possibly not of their own doing, were caught napping, and three senior members of their staff resigned simultaneously. That raised no red flags, nobody asked any questions, nobody was worried, nobody investigated. And they haven't even looked at the exit interview. So those are my view. I don't have any questions because the answers will be at the appropriate time. We'll share with you the information. So I don't need that answer, but those are my views. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mr. Gojela.
Thank you, Chair. I think Honorable President Bach has covered me on the last one, that we it's important that the SG must up the issue of, you know, being careful of these things happening within the department, because if we're going to get answers which says what happens happened, it really makes us feel like everybody does whatever they like within the department, and the outcomes thereof will be such, and it will shock us even in future if we don't follow up on these issues and watch exactly close the processes of the department. But Chair, my question, my other question is on the issue of updates. I wanted to find out from the SG if updates on the review of the, is there any update on the review of the supply chain management processes, and if maybe was there any gaps which have been identified to date, or maybe any remedies in terms of the gaps if they happen to find anything wrong within the space, Chair. And also, have they, if there's anything that might be prevented, or the remedies, in terms of the remedies, have they asked or the assistant from the Auditor General?
We could not hear you after the Auditor General. Can you repeat what you wanted to say?
Okay, I'm sorry for that, Chair. My question is that the progress report on the review of active contracts, is there any impropriety, Chair, if they can check that one, particularly on within the information technology, communication technology, and also, Chair, give us information on. Thank you, Chair. Lastly, the plans that they might be, maybe because they are aware that there's a serious problem in those areas of procurement, do they have plans in terms of monitoring this closely, Chair? The issue of procurement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. SJ?
Honorable Chairperson, I think I had forgotten Mr. Swartz, Honorable Swartz, issue around the when we appeared on the 3rd of May, whether we knew, and the question and the answer is no, we did not when we met with the portfolio committee on the 3rd of May. The letters of resignation were received in the HR on the 3rd and the 4th and the 6th of May, which was thereafter. The risk with regards to not paying contract is a matter that we are discussing with our councils. We are understanding of the risk of a breach of contract, etc. But both the OCJ and Thompson Writers sit with a problem with regards to this company and the three officials. So the invoices will be considered within the context of that. The fact is, yes, services have been rendered. The fact is, yes, the system is operating, as I've already indicated, and lawyers and judges are using, the users are using the system. Therefore, technically speaking, we have to pay the services that we have been receiving. But I am not comfortable, subject to counsel, to be just paying under the circumstances without OCJ and Thompson Writers resolving some of these issues with regards to that. And I am committing that I'm aware of the risk with regards to paying, which I am managing together with our councils. On regular updates on the impact of civil litigation in Gauteng, I'll stand to be guided by the committee on that to understand the impact of the case lines and the situation that we are faced with on the courts. But I can assure the committee as we sit that the case line system or the court online system is operational in Gauteng, in both Johannesburg and Gauteng, as it was supposed to be. As I've said, the subcontracting is not done. I mean, the phase, what is this one? So the phase, level one and two services, which are supposed to be given by the subcontractor, support and maintenance are being given as they should. The only difference is that it's not by the subcontractor, it is by the Thompson writers themselves. I'll be guided by the committee on the updates. We will be ready to do that on the updates. But as today, there isn't any negative impact yet. There was a question relating to the investigate. Does the investigation touch also on the setup of this company? And the silent partners and the unknown people being involved in that. The investigation also involved by the law enforcement agency also involves the contractor. It's not only us on the side of the OCJ that we are subject to the investigation. The Thompson writers also and what they have done with regard to subcontracting is also part of the investigation. We are aware that they've been raised. The law enforcement agency have asked them questions relating to this matter. And for fear of my answer becomes the same that things are in the investigation space. I do apologize and understand the frustration. I am at pains also to want to share also the information with the committee as it is your role in terms of the constitution to do oversight. But I will be compromising the investigation. I have taken counsel also before the committee to be advised on how one should deal with this because there is one is sitting between a hard rock and a hard place in terms of being able to provide information at the same time, not affecting the investigation as well as the advice that counsel is cautioning us against with regards to the company, the subcontractor, the OCJ and the impact thereof, that we shouldn't ventilate issues which could later be ventilated in the court because there is possible litigation that is going to come out of these issues. And under that counsel advice, I appeal to the committee to understand. I understand the frustration. Any person in your position will feel the same way. The local company, yes, according to the records at our disposal, the subcontractor had no trading experience therefore they did not, as a local company, they had traded on the first day when after they had left the institution. I take the criticism on the exit interview, but maybe the context is with limited capacity and with the crisis that one is faced with. One has to make choices to focus on the most difficult aspects of dealing with the procurement issues and the risk in SCM that one has faced. But as I've indicated, one of the DDG for Coal Administration is here. What he shares with me is that the Chief Director of Coal Administration indicated that he's going to private practice. I think that was verbal. We will still check the interview, exit interview, but as I've indicated, usually our experience is that you don't get much out of that. I take the criticism if the committee is of the view that I neglected that part, but there were more urgent things that one needed to look at. On the disclosure of interest, which all SMS members and other officials below that are prescribed to disclose. I confirm that the three officials did disclose in their end of April 2022 disclosure, which they did on the last day, 30 April 2022, before the system closed. I take the criticism from Honorable Breitenbach for the frustration that you are enduring with the committee with regards to not being able to share the information And I think the track record of the OCJ speaks for itself. It's not because we are trying to hide anything from the committee. I really appeal that one is sitting in a very difficult situation. I appreciate this happened under my watch. I take my responsibility seriously, but I appeal that we let the process unfold, and I will present myself to be grilled at the appropriate time. And I understand how you feel about that. With regards to this having happened, what are the gaps that have been identified, and the any remedies or the plan to close this in the SCM? We have indicated, we have identified in the SCM because of capacity, the lack of more officials in that space, so that we are able to segregate some of the duties. And which also impacts what I've already said with regard to sitting in the committees. You end up having people sitting in different levels because we are a small department. And as I've said, getting people from outside is a problem. It delays our procurement plans, it delays our processes. It is not an excuse, but I'm saying that this reality we are faced with. So that is the SCM, and we have tightened the SCM and increase more senior managers to do oversight over SCM so that more than one eye can look at these things. Also, we have put in place mechanism whereby the risk management unit will also look at the companies as soon as they are going to a certain level of evaluation, at the evaluation stage before the adjudication, so that the companies can be looked at through the applicable systems and not rely only on the forms on conflict of interest declarations, because as you would understand, tender documents are too huge. It will be very difficult to really, with the capacity we have, do everything, but we have put in place that mechanism. Risk unit is under instruction to ensure that any company that goes through the procurement system must be checked on the side of us officials' involvement with the companies, on the other side, on the company having had any involvement previously with any of us, and their capacity to be able to deliver. I don't know if there's any other question that I've left behind. Mm-hmm. What is it? Or have we asked for help from the AG? That's a question that I think is outstanding. The Auditor General did, obviously, subsequent to the story in the media, contact us, and we have with them looked at the environment with regard to ICT, and we have asked them, we agreed with them that going forward, they will also make sure that when it comes to ICT, where the money, the bulk of the money is spent, as well as where the risks are, given this incident that has happened, that they will look at. They have identified certain areas in ICT, which will come out of the audit report, and we will deal with that at the audit reporting stage in this instance. But they did contact us when it comes to this issue, when it hits the papers. I've done with the disclosure. Chairperson, I'm your hand. I don't know if there's anything that one did not look at, one did not respond to.
No, from my side, I don't see any. Unless members would indicate if one of their questions is not answered, Honorable Swart.
Chair, I just wanted your guidance. Maybe we can discuss the follow-ups in as much as regular reporting to the committee as to progress and impact on civil litigation. I think that is very important, but I'll be guided by you and the committee as to how regular that should be. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Now, that was going to be part of the way forward. Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Thank you very much, Honorable SJ, and to your team. We do understand, and I think you also understand the frustration on our part. We take the work of the judiciary very seriously and its reputation very seriously. What has happened is unfortunate. But we also do understand that the investigations are continuing, and you have indicated that from the look of things, by the 30th of September, the investigation might be done. So what we would do is to schedule the first engagement with yourselves and the office of the Chief Justice in the first week of October when we come back for the BRRR. We will schedule you so that you can update us on the progress and also on the issues that have been raised on the case lines, the civil litigations, how the impact, how are they impacted. And so we would meet with you, and then we will, after receiving that report, we will discuss the frequency of report thereafter, whether they would be in person or be in writing. Because I'm looking also at the trying to balance the gravity of the situation that is faced by the Office of the Chief Justice and the ability of the committee, based on the work that is before it, that we might not be able to have every time we meet with you, have a meeting. Maybe sometime we would, upon discussion, accept a written update. But the first update in October will be a full meeting with the committee where you will update us. And then we will decide as to when do you come back again, either in the form of a written report or in the form of a full meeting. I think that would be all, members.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, for your time.
Oh. Honorable Sort?
I am in agreement with the proposal, but I would ask the SG if there is any danger about case lines or anything that happens in the interim, that we should be alerted immediately in writing, because we would, obviously, legal firms would be contacting us if there's a problem. So you've given us the assurance that it shouldn't happen, but yes. Chair, with your permission, would that be in order if there is any problem in that regard? Thank you, Chair.
No, that's fine, Honorable Sort. And I will accordingly distribute the information if it is shared with me. Thank you very much. Thank you, SG, and to your team.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, for the time. And I apologize for frustrating you with the responses. And I understand your frustration. I take it seriously. And I assure you that we do our best with limited resources to correct what has happened and ensure that it does not recur going forward. And I publicly apologize to the judiciary, which administration I lead, for such an occurrence. And we will continue to ensure that the integrity of the judiciary is not affected. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, SG. Members, can we take a 10-minute break? Then we will start with the land bill and court bill. I'm not sure whether Mr. Roberts, maybe we will call you when we are done, because it might take some time. Or maybe members, you would have received an opinion yesterday on the cannabis bill. I'm not sure whether we should start with cannabis or we should start with the land court so that we can discuss opinion, because it has got an impact on how we will need to process the bill. I am in your hands. Mr. Duplessis, I see your hand.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. And I apologize for interrupting your discussion with your committee members. But with regard to the note that we submitted in respect of the land court bill, I think we will be able to do that fairly quickly. So we would like to propose to the chairperson that we might stand down after Mr. Roberts had the opportunity to take the committee through the opinion, because I think that might need a bit more time. But we will be able to run through our note, if I may use that word, fairly quickly, within 10 or 15 minutes. Thank you, Chair.
I know that is a very good intervention, Mr. Duplessis. The 15 minutes one is a very good intervention. It's encouraging. Members, I'm in your hands. Just before we break, but I think Mr. Duplessis has assisted us. I'm in your hands, Honorable Swart.
Shouldn't we then do the land court bill after the break, that 15 minutes, get that finished, and then we can move over to the cannabis bill and spend all our time on that?
Okay, there's a contrary view, Honorable Yap.
I think whichever one will be expedited first, we should do, and then the latter one we then do, so that we can spend more time on it.
Okay. No, I think members, let's do it like that. So we will come back at 10 past 11, and then we will do the land court bill followed by the cannabis bill. Thank you very much. Let's meet at 11 minutes past 10. Welcome back, members. Mr. Dupuis, can you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to share the screen with you. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, we have submitted this document a couple of days ago to the committee. I'm not going to go through it line by line with your permission. I would rather like to speak to the document itself. But just by way of introduction of or background information, the committee or a number of interested parties expressed their concern regarding the proposed exclusive jurisdiction of the Land Court as a court of final instance in exclusion to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and then the issue of a compulsory arbitration, which is currently contained in the Land Court Bill as introduced, and then also the possibility of bringing the expropriation bill under the exclusive jurisdiction of the Land Court. We make reference to previous meetings of the committee in paragraphs 1.2 and 1.3, and then I would like to highlight in paragraph 1.3 that the committee also requested the department on 25 May this year to conduct research and do a briefing on the concept of equity. And Mr. Chair, I apologize, but I'm going to interrupt myself for a minute and just to say that my chief director, Mr. Advocate Sibylla Mecha, and my team member, Mr. Makulubete, is also on the platform. And I, with your permission, I would like to, at the conclusion of going through this document, maybe hand over to Mr. Makulubete if he wants to add anything. Mr. Chair, in short, with regard to paragraph 2 and the subparagraphs thereunder, in responding to the concerns that the bill cannot at this stage exclude the Supreme Court of Appeals jurisdiction in hearing appeals from emanating from the bill, we highlighted in paragraph 2.2 the provisions of section 166 of the Constitution, which sets out the hierarchy of courts of the Republic, namely the Constitutional Court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, and then a High Court of South Africa, and any High Court of Appeal that may be established by an Act of Parliament to hear appeals from any court of a status similar to a High Court, and then, of course, the Magistrates' Courts, and then also, importantly, subparagraph E, any other court established or recognized in terms of an Act of Parliament, including any court of a status similar to either the High Court or the Magistrates' Courts. In paragraph 2, we just explained the implication of section 166C and 166E, but more importantly, Mr. Chair, and this is going to be the crux of the matter that we would like to propose to the committee and then also request the committee's guidance, is section 168 of the Constitution, and sub 3A provides that the Supreme Court of Appeal may decide appeals in any matter arising from the High Court of South Africa or a court of similar status to the High Court of South Africa, except in respect of labor or competition matters. Now, Mr. Chair, we refer to clause 34.2 of the bill as it currently stands in the bill as introduced. I'm not going to bore you with the detail or read it line by line for you. We have submitted the document. We also refer to a case that has been decided by the Supreme Court of Appeal. Once again, I don't think we need to really bore you with the detail there. Mr. Chair, and then in paragraph 2.9, we indicate that a concern has also been raised as to what would be the necessity of having a Land Court of Appeal and if the SEA is given an appellate jurisdiction over land matters from the Land Court of Appeal as it currently stands in section 168 of the Constitution. And we have indicated to the committee that there will be various options then available, which we highlight in paragraph 2.9 A, B, and C, and then in paragraphs 2.10 and further on, we provide the committee with background information. If I may just go back to paragraph 2.9, Mr. Chair, this is an issue that was raised, if I remember correctly, by the chairperson himself at the previous meeting of the committee. The concern was expressed that it would appear that an extra layer of appeal will be added to the whole structure of adjudicating disputes. Mr. Chair, I'm once again not going to go in too much detail here because the information is available to the committee. The second option is then, of course, the removal of the Land Court of Appeal. And then the third option or possible way forward is then the amendment of the Constitution in similar vein to excluding then the Supreme Court of Appeals jurisdiction when it comes to competition and labor matters. Now, before we go over to paragraph 3, Mr. Chair, the department would like to propose at the committee at this stage that the committee should consider not proceeding with establishing a Land Court of Appeal, among others, in view of austerity measures that must be taken at this stage. It will be quite a significant amount of money to establish the Land Court of Appeal. And then also it will require an amendment to the Constitution, and that is where we would like to, in a nutshell, request the committee's guidance, whether the committee feels that in the foreseeable future, a Land Court of Appeal should be created, which would then necessitate an amendment to the Constitution. So the department would like to request the committee what the committee's feeling at this stage would be to consider in the near future then a proposed amendment to the Constitution to pave the way for the creation of a proper Land Court of Appeal. When it comes to paragraph 3, Mr. Chair, we've also given background information to the committee that there were discussions when the two bills were developed. And we also indicate to the committee, and I would like to, with your permission, Mr. Chair, focus on paragraph 3.4. So the history of the two bills, they are now running concurrently in Parliament. And we have explained to the committee previously that we are not in a position technically to insert proposed amendments in the schedule to the Land Court bill referring or proposing to amend a bill which is also currently being considered in Parliament. However, Mr. Chair, and I think you would have noted, I can't remember the exact date, but it's early or mid-September that the National Assembly is scheduled to vote on the expropriation bill. We have had sight of the A list of the bill that will be presented to the National Assembly for approval, or rather than the B list eventually. And in that A list, and this is what I would like to highlight to the committee, is that the definition of court will then be amended to say that, or to say that a court means a High Court of South Africa, or any court of a similar status to the High Court of South Africa, within whose area of jurisdiction paragraphs A to D, 2D may be applicable. So the introductory part of the definition is important, Mr. Chair, to the extent that that paves the way for the Land Court of Appeal to have, the Land Court to have jurisdiction in respect of expropriation matters. It might be that in future to clarify that entirely and to ensure exclusive jurisdiction to the Land Court, that the definition might have to be amended. Mr. Chair, with regard to arbitration, once again, by background information, the bill aimed to introduce a compulsory system of arbitration. The department has noted the concerns that were expressed by committee members as well as interested parties. And the department concedes, Mr. Chair, that reference to arbitration should rather be removed from the bill because it will only cause confusion. Arbitration will in any event be available to parties who wish not to get matters adjudicated in the court system, but rather opt for the option of arbitration then. And then there was also a question raised in the committee, and this is paragraph 4.4, Mr. Chair, that or the question was raised whether it would not be possible for a judge of the Land Claims Court to act as an arbitrator. But we have received and we've also drawn the committee's attention to the submission by the Land Claims Court to the effect that the court cannot act as arbitrator. So the department also concedes that this is not an option. So with reference to paragraph 4, Mr. Chair, the department would like to highlight to the committee that the whole reference to compulsory arbitration will be removed from the bill if the committee agrees with the recommendation by the department. Mr. Chair, I'm terribly sorry. I don't know why this always happens to me. Please excuse me for a moment.
No problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then there was also the question raised about the concept of law and equity in the committee. Clause 3.1 of the bill aims to establish Land Court as a court of law and equity. And clause 3.4 is also there to be noted by the committee. But what we would like to highlight, Mr. Chair, is that these clauses are similar to sections 151 and 167 of the Labour Relations Act, which then, and specifically then with regard to 151, that the Labour Court is established as a court of law and equity. We also refer in paragraph B to section 22 of the Restitution Act, which then also makes provision for matters of equity to be considered. And then also we, in paragraph D, we quote section 33C of the Restitution of Land Rights Act, where among others then factors to be taken into consideration by the Land Claims Court are the requirements of equity and justice. Mr. Chair, once again, research was done with regard to case law. We quote some of those cases there for you. Once again, I don't think it's really necessary to go through those line for line. One would possibly, with your permission, Mr. Chair, then get to the conclusion under this heading, and that is paragraph G, where the department indicates that we are of the view that land court should be established as a court of law and equity, as provided for in clause 3.1 of the bill. Furthermore, Mr. Chair, to establish the land court as a court of law and equity will also enable the court to apply equitable considerations when dealing with the admissibility of hearsay evidence, in addition to the obligation imposed on the court to look at the relevance and cogency of the evidence presented before it. The reason why the Restitution of Land Rights Act makes provision for a court of law and equity is then, of course, of the magnitude of the matters to be considered by that court, and we would like to propose that approach be followed with regard to the land court as provided for in the bill itself. Mr. Chair, I would like to conclude under this paragraph and highlight paragraph F for the chairperson and the committee members to note, and that is, it must be pointed out that even the word equity is not included in the bill, the court would still be able to take into account just and equitable considerations in reaching its decision by applying its inherent powers as accorded to it in the Constitution. However, we would like, or the department would like, to recommend that the words reference to equity should expressly be reflected in the bill, and it does not prevent the committee from doing so merely because the constitution provides for equitable considerations in any event. Mr. Chair, with regard to the conclusion and way forward, we would like to highlight to the committee then, and I'm not going to go through this with you, Mr. Chair, because we would like to say, first of all, when it comes to the Land Court of Appeal, the department recommends at this stage that that appeal structure should not be proceeded with in the bill at this stage, but would like the committee to consider creating a Land Court of Appeal in the near future, subject then, of course, to the committee being amenable to propose or to accept a proposed amendment to the Constitution, and then specifically Section 168 of the Constitution, to provide for that leeway that the Land Court of Appeal can then be a court of final instance. With regard to the whole issue of arbitration referenced in paragraph B, the department recommends that the whole issue of compulsory arbitration should then be removed from the bill. And then in paragraph C, we submit, or the department submits, that the expropriation bill cannot be included under the exclusive jurisdiction of the land court at this stage, since the expropriation bill is also still being considered by Parliament. And then with regard to paragraph B, D, my apologies, we would like to then focus our attention to the land court and then recommend that that court should be established as a law, a court of law and equity. Mr. Chair, that in a nutshell is our summary, and please excuse me if you feel that I've went through it too fast, but I'm mindful of the fact that Mr. Roberts is also still in the queue, and I would like to maybe leave it at that, and with your permission, maybe ask Mr. Makudubete or my chief director whether they have something to add at this stage. Thank you, Chair.
Before you proceed, let's go to the last paragraph C at the end, your way forward.
Paragraph C, yes, Mr. Chair.
Because we're also intending to pass this bill around September. This exclusion of expropriation bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you will recall that I've just earlier quoted the proposed definition then that will be included in the expropriation bill. So that will pave the way to a certain extent for the land courts to have jurisdiction in respect of expropriation matters. The problem that we're facing at this stage is more of a technical implementational concern, and that is that we can't foresee at this stage which one of the two bills will commence first after they've been signed into law by the president. So it might be that the Land Court Act, if I call it then, that will commence prior to the expropriation bill, which will make life a bit difficult with regard to cross-referencing to the Expropriation Act or the expropriation bill. The solution we see at this stage is that the definition of court will assist us in ensuring that matters may be referred then to the land court, Chair.
No, I'm covered. Mr. Makudubete?
Chair, before you...
Good morning, Chair, and honorable members. I'm thankful to my colleague, Mr. Dupree. He has given the summary, and I do not have anything further to add on what he has submitted. Thank you, Chair and members.
Thank you very much, honorable Mr. Kwajala.
Chair, I wanted to thank you. Thank you very much also to Mr. Dupree. I just wanted, Chair, to comment on that issue of the expropriation. I wanted to ask Mr. Dupree if the issue of, if, for example, that matter of expropriation is left in this bill, but also in reference to the expropriation in terms of what the Constitution is saying now. Is there any possibility for that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Jala. Honorable Niwot Trukhan.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. Thank you for the presentation. So I'd like to ask Mr. Dupree, the Court of Law and Equity, that phrasing, why must that be in the bill? Why must that phrase be mentioned specifically in the bill? I'd like to understand that concept further. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. I just need your guidance. Are we asking questions of clarity, or are we going to engage at a later stage on deliberations? I just, on issues of clarity, the issues around the Supreme Court of Appeal, I picked this up right at the beginning when the department gave its presentation. It's a very straightforward issue. And we are now, if you look at the bill and you look at departments and bodies consulted, this bill was presented by the Interministerial Committee on the 20th of November 2020, now almost 2 years later, when it's very obvious that the Supreme Court of Appeal could not be excluded without a constitutional amendment. Now we're sitting with a situation now that should it be desirable that the Land Appeal Court asks the Supreme Court of Appeal, it will require a constitutional amendment. We've been under a lot of pressure to pass this bill, and so it's regrettable that almost 2 years later we're sitting with this situation. But be that as it may, it's very clear now that the way forward, as indicated, whilst there are two options, would be to pass the bill as present, to remove the issue deleting the SCA's jurisdiction, and to then consider putting in due course, the ASTA clause, which would require a constitutional amendment. That would then result in a number of issues which we would need to deliberate. And I just want to ask Mr. Dupre, is he saying that the department is recommending that there should still be a Land Court of Appeal plus the SCA, or that clearly it's our option, or would we consider deleting the Land Court of Appeal and having only the SCA until the full Land Court of Appeal is set up? Mr. Dupre pointed out financial constraints, and of course the delay, they would require a constitutional amendment would be required, which would delay the passing of this bill. So I just needed some clarity on the two options and whether the department has, I might not have been clear on hearing the department's specific recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair, Honourable Wilmer here. My apologies for, okay, the secretary has fixed the problem. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Honourable Rittenberg.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm covered by Mr. Schwartz's input. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Jelle, is it an old hand or a new hand?
It's a new hand,
sir.
Sorry, Chair, I was confused, like Mr. Schwartz, Honourable Schwartz, as to the issues of questions of clarity or also getting into the matter. But even if it's like that, Chair, but I wanted, I'm covered by Honourable Schwartz, but in addition to that, I wanted to find out if, because in the Constitutional Review Committee, the amendments that are going to be done soon on the Constitution. Is it not possible maybe to liaise with check with the committee and see if maybe when that happens, because that needs two-third majority, so even this one obviously is going to need that. When that happens, this one also piggybacking on that one, Chair. I'm not sure. I wanted to find out if is there any possibility for that, so that we don't temper with we leave the matter as it is on the issue of the constitutional review subject. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. I think firstly we are parties here. Maybe members might want to get mandates from their parties as to the feasibility of changing the constitution, because there is no one party that can do that. We would need a two-third majority, as Honourable Jelle has said. But I think for the purposes of the bill, now. I think we should proceed as suggested, but I think as we are busy deliberating, I think members would be able to indicate the stance of their caucuses, because if political parties would not be willing and we might not get the two-thirds majority. So, but we need to pass the bill. So I think it would be important that the issue of the changing of the constitution, members go back to their parties and get a mandate. But in case we do not get that, I think we should proceed with the bill, with the exclusion of the Land Court of Appeal and using the Supreme Court of Appeal as proposed. Is that in order?
Sorry,
Chair. I agree, Chair.
Agree.
Thank you, Honorable Sort.
Chair, my only concern is the possible delays there. Even if parties should come back and support a constitutional amendment, that you've got to restart the whole process of this building. And that would be a separate, that would probably be a separate building. So I hear what you say, and I'm not necessarily opposed to that process, whilst obviously one will get a party position. My concern is that delays then in the passing of this bill, should that be the option that we follow. But clearly one doesn't want to preempt the process, but I think in parties' consideration, I think it's important to also note that it will result in a number of delays in should that be the should the way forward be to amend the constitution to make provision now as soon as possible. But I leave it for the parties to consider that issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Horn.
Yes, Chair, I tend to agree with the Honorable Swart. I mean, it's quite clear that in order to amend the constitution would in terms of the constitution require a dedicated process which entails public participation, and there's specific period of time in terms of the constitution which should lapse after a bill to amend the constitution has been introduced before there can be a vote on it. So I mean, I'm not closing the door on amending the constitution, and as a consequence, the law to set up a dedicated land court of appeal. But if our interest is now to finalize this as soon as possible, I don't think we have any other option but for now to remove a reference to the Land Court of Appeal. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any other view on this matter? I think Honorable Jelly.
My question was going to be, if we remove that, Chair, what is the advantage or the disadvantage on this matter? Because the department saw it necessary to include that. Maybe if I can be given an explanation in terms of what will be the negative and the positive of removing that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think if I understand members correctly, and even Mr. Dupree, the issue of the amendment to the constitution, and the view was that if after we have passed the bill, there is still an appetite to amend the constitution, but clearly, looking at the constitution as it is now, you cannot have an appeal court other than the Supreme Court of Appeal. That is what the Constitution says to us now. So we can only have an equivalent of the High Court, and any appeal would need to go to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And I think the issue, Honorable Jelle, if I understand your question correctly, I think the department is conceding that they were wrong with the issue of the Supreme Court of Appeal. That is why they are suggesting one, the other possibility, which is currently not provided for in terms of the framework as the Constitution is currently crafted, that the Constitution might be amended, which I think would be another long process, and it will also depend on the appetite of other political parties, whether they would want to support that. But the issue is that for now, we need to pass the bill in terms of the Constitution as it is now, if we are to meet the deadlines that we had set for ourselves. Is that understandable, Honorable Jen?
Yes, Chair. I think I'm covered. But now we have to make sure that we assist in terms of capacity, the Supreme Court of Appeal, because now the pressure is going to be on the Supreme Court of Appeal. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, yes. That's true. Thank you very much. Honorable Swart?
Chair, I think Mr. Dupre did add one element there, and that is you have the land court, and then you can have an appeal to a full bench of the land court,
yes,
which is three judges,
yes,
even if the land appeal court is removed. So you would, as presently, if I understand it correctly, you'd have the land court, you could have an appeal to a full bench of three judges of the land court, then you would have an appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal, as opposed to the Land Appeal Court. In the, and that obviously one wants to bring an end to litigation otherwise. And then the final appeal, if it's a constitutional matter, is to the Constitutional Court. So I think there would be an element of an appeal to a full bench as well, which is important. Thank you.
Yes, which is currently happening even now on other matters.
I'm covered, Chief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So do I understand the committee to be saying we stick with the status quo, the land court, the full bench, Supreme Court of Appeal, and the Constitutional Court?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
Thank you,
members. Honorable Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was just, I think, during this discussion, the one question that was raised, well, actually two, and I'm going to ask Mr. Makudubete to address the committee on the advantage of including the words law and equity in the phrase where it appears. But with regard to the question regarding expropriation and the Constitution and whether there should be reference made of expropriation in this bill, we have explained at a previous meeting of the committee and even during the briefing of the committee that this bill does not aim to really amend substantive law. And as soon as we refer to expropriation and Section 25 of the Constitution, those are issues that are being dealt with in the expropriation bill, and one would not want to include substantive provisions of that nature in a bill which actually deals exclusively with a structure of the court itself. Thank you, Chair. With your permission, I'm going to hand over to Mr. Makudubete.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of equity during this briefing, Mr. Dupre did indicate that we have followed the structure of the courts as contained in the Labor Relations Act, in terms of which the Labor Court and the Labor Appeal Court are established as courts of law and equity. Chair, if I may request Mr. Dupre to scroll the presentation to page 10, where the Nehao case is being briefly outlined. The The court said in that judgment, if Mr. Dupuy can highlight six from the top, where the court was talking about the old industrial court, which was established by the old 1956 Labor Relations Act. The court acknowledges there that the industrial court, which is the court that was replaced by the current labor court, that industrial court was established as a court of equity, and other matters had to be dealt with in the High Court. However, with the advent of the Labor Relations Act, there was a change of heart by the legislature in terms of which when the industrial court was replaced by the Labor Relations Act, the labor court was established as a court of law and equity. In addition to that, the Labor Relations Act established the Labor Appeal Court as a court of law and equity. Our understanding, Chair and Honorable Members, is that when the court is established as a court of law and equity, the court will be able to obviously apply the law. However, in instances where there will be injustice in the application of the law, then the court will still be able to apply equitable considerations. Now, hence we are of the view that if the committee is still agreeable, we rather have this court, that is the Land Court, also established as a law as a court of law and equity, and so as the court can be able to apply the law as well as equitable considerations. Hence, then we know, Chair and Honorable Members, that our high courts have got this inherent jurisdiction in terms of which they are able to still apply equitable considerations. However, if we have this expression of the court being established as a court of law and equity, it leaves the expression beyond doubt that the court can be able to apply equitable considerations. That is all I can say in relation to this, Honorable Chair and Members. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Makolubet. Honorable Jelle, is that an old hand or a new hand?
Old hand, I think.
Okay, thank you. Members, are we satisfied? Or are there any questions of debate on the issues that have been raised, or we allow them to go and redraft and we look at the polished draft?
Polished draft, Chair. I think we're done with it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you very much, Mr. Dupree, and to your team for the good work. How much time would you need? Because we can't say you must come tomorrow. I think you have done enough for the week. We will call you. I think the committee secretary will advise. When are we meeting them again after tomorrow?
Chairperson, we were supposed to meet them on the 30th, which is next week on Tuesday.
Okay. So that will it be enough time, Mr. Dupree and your team?
Mr. Chair, yes, it will. It all depends on whether we get final guidance from our seniors within the department, but we will be able to present a document to the committee on the 30th. Thank you, Chair.
No, your seniors in the department, tell them that the committee is the parliamentary process, so we want a process to be done by the 30th. So whatever they decide, it cannot affect the work of this parliament.
Much appreciated, Chair, and my apologies. I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Dupree, and to your team. Members, it's 5 to 12. Would you want to break for lunch, or should we proceed with Mr. Robertson?
Should we have a break, Chair, because it's going to be a very lengthy period with Mr. Robertson.
Okay.
I'm in your hands, then. I'm in your hands.
Okay. Maybe can you come back at 1? Thank you very much. We'll come back at 1 o'clock.
Recording stopped.